evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Elise Vernon Perlstein. She's a former wildlife biologist and now is a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator. We're continuing our conversation about her book, Scent, A Natural History of Fragrance. Elise, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hi, thanks. I'm so excited to talk some more to you. I enjoyed our last interview.
Now, we were talking before about fragrant woods. We talked about agarwood, and I wanted to make sure we mentioned sandalwood, because sandalwood is one of those things that everybody, I think, has heard of, as opposed to agarwood, but nobody really knows what it smells like.
It's tricky. It's hard to describe one of those, and I know I say this.
Well, can I read your quote in the book? Because people need to know that you really go into these really beautiful descriptions of these scents. Sandalwood asks you to be patient. At the beginning, it may appear that there is nothing on the scent strip, but a moment of quiet will reward the nose with a fragrance that is so rich and complex that you may not be able to come up with terms to describe it. And then you go on to describing what the smell is like. Is that, by the way, is that part of the challenge of working in scents, is coming up with verbal descriptors?
It is. And I have spent a long time kind of coming up with my own words. Sometimes I will go out to blogs and references that do also describe the same things. And sometimes there are words that other people can say that help me out, but a lot of times I will sit here with the fragrance on a scent strip in front of me and think and go away and think. And
is part of that
it's hard.
Is part of that we do not have a great vocabulary for describing olfactory sensations?
Totally, yes. When I started perfumery, I got a list of words, and most of them are familiar: sweet, sharp,
yeah,
flowery, rosy, green, herbal, cinnamony, you know, but that doesn't always distinguish different woods from each other or different flowers from each other.
Yeah, it's very general.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I came to sandalwood, there's definitely a wood note, and you have to kind of use the word resin, but it's not a sharp resin. It's more like a really soft resin. A lot of people refer to it as creamy and milky, skin tones.
Whoa, okay, can I just stop you there? When you say, you mean like the smell of your skin?
Yeah, which is, again, kind of hard to describe.
Wow.
But in general, it blends nicely with skin. It sits there on your skin and maybe makes it a little bit better, makes it, you know, it works with skin really well.
Now, where's sandalwood found? Is it just from one place in the world?
No, sandalwood is best known from India, and that's kind of the standard by which we judge a lot of the sandalwoods, but it's originally actually probably from Australia. Huh. Sandalwood has been found in Hawaii and the Pacific area around there.
Wow.
There was a sandalwood tree on the islands off the coast of South America that is now extinct. So it's actually a fairly widespread tree. And it turns out that Australia has, in addition to growing their own native sandalwood, naturally, a lot of people are growing sandalwood around its natural habitat in plantations. And in Australia, they've started doing plantations of sandalwood native to Australia, but also the Indian sandalwood. Just recently, they've started trying to grow that because it's in such danger in India itself.
Well, this brings up two questions I have. One is, are a lot of these natural scents and the sources of them actually in danger of becoming extinct?
A lot of the trees are.
Okay.
Because, you know, we talked about agarwood, and that's in danger. I talk about conifers, pine trees, and those, which we don't always think about in perfume, but the southeastern U.S. provided a lot of the turpentine, which is actually a building block for extracting or creating fragrant ingredients. They chemically alter the turpentine to get some of the perfume ingredients. Those trees are in danger.
Now, when you're talking about the sandalwoods, do all the sandalwoods smell the same, or do they have, like, the Indian is different from the Australian?
There are very subtle differences. The Indian is, you know, very full-bodied, very rich skin tones, precious wood. The Australian is a little bit sharper. A really nice one can have almost some citrus notes.
Wow.
There's a New Caledonian one that I love that is very smooth, very easy to like, maybe not as charismatic, but it's really easy to work with. And the Hawaiian one I love, which is, I describe it as having kind of old library precious wood notes.
Oh, I love that. I love that smell.
Yeah, yeah. But they all come down to, in the end, a very characteristic sandalwood, what we call the dry down, that aroma that's left for hours and hours, either on your skin or in the perfume or on a scent strip.
Now, this may be a silly question, but is there a difference in quality between sort of woods that are grown artificially in like farms and wild woods? In other words, it could be the same species of sandalwood, but it, you know how they talk about free-range chickens versus penned-up chickens. Is there a difference in the smell between, you know, grown artificially sandalwoods versus, you know, wild sandalwoods or wild any kind of source of scent?
Sure. With sandalwood, the very best of the sandalwood is obtained from the trunk and actually the roots. And it's very best after about 40 years, 50 years. And I think I say in the book somewhere that sandalwood is best when it grows where it belongs.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly. So it has sort of the aroma equivalent of terroir.
Yeah, yeah, to some extent. A lot of Indians will grow sandalwood in their home gardens. In Australia, they are growing the native sandalwood, and they're growing them in plantations. And one of the things about sandalwood is that the saplings need a partner. They're semi or hemiparasitic. Their roots need to be able to reach out and join with a nearby plant. And they don't really suck off nutrients, but they share, you know, water and nutrients with their sort of host plant. As they get older, they can be more independent. There's a plantation in Australia that I was talking to the managers for, and they make sure, and they're growing the Indian sandalwood and the Australian, and they make sure to use native plants as those host plants. And so what they've done on the plantation is created kind of an artificial but somewhat mimicking natural conditions with native plants and the sandalwood. They don't really probably have the luxury to let these trees sit for 40 years.
Yeah.
But they can, you know, after 10 years begin to harvest, and they will actually analyze the sandalwood and blend it so they can make more of a commercial product for maybe a big company that wants a particular aromatic profile. Which is a long way to say that sandalwood in India and one thing at 40 years old, you know, is one thing.
So these woods are like wine. they take aging?
Sure.
So the older woods always smell better than younger woods? Okay.
I wouldn't say always, but I would say yes.
Okay.
And it's this heartwood that comes from just aging. There's no response to disease or need for attraction or protection. It just simply comes from growing older. And it accumulates from the outside in into these dark central parts of the tree. That's a nice thing to think about. If you're a perfumer, there may be something else you're looking for.
Well, you know, I never got a chance to talk to you about what it's like to be a perfumer. And especially hearing you talk about sandalwood, which seems very subtle. People come to you and they probably want a personal scent, right? That's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Do these things all blend together easily? Or, I mean, it seems like these are all chemicals and some may get along with others, but you may mix two other ones and they could come up with something that's just really awful.
Totally. Yes.
So that does happen. Okay. This is all
a
mystery to me. So,
I don't automatically say never, ever put these two together, because it depends on maybe there's a third thing that helps them to work.
Okay.
It's especially hard working with essential oils and natural aromatics, because they may have 200 or 300 individual constituents within, say, the rose or the sandalwood. And so you spend a lot of time getting to know them. You might start with putting them on paper, on the blotters, the scent strips, and pairing those together. You might walk around with them, and then most perfumers will just do a whole suite of different tests, maybe change the proportions a little bit, or add this or take that out. So there's a lot of experimentation and iterations.
When a person comes to you to develop a scent, has there ever been conflict? I'm not looking for names, but like between what you think is a good scent and then what they recognize, because I have to believe that a lot of people don't have a trained olfactory, nose like you do. So what you will smell could be a lot more subtler than what they're looking for.
Sure. Yeah, totally. There's never been a conflict. People are going to like what they're going to like. And I had one, actually, a little girl who walked away with a perfume that was mostly clove and lavender, I think.
Wow.
And I talked to her, and it was really not very pretty, but it was striking.
But it was striking.
And I talked to her, and I said, do you want to add some of this? And, no, I really like it. And I thought, well, okay. But what I will do, a lot of times somebody will work out a perfume, and they'll put this and that. And I've always got jasmine, and probably 20% maybe say, I just don't like jasmine. But I will say, okay, let's take this and just add one tiny drop of the jasmine. You won't smell it, but you will be able to see what it does to the blend.
That's fascinating.
And that's kind of where the perfumer's perceptions come in, is understanding that even if you can't smell it, it makes a difference.
This is where scent making is a lot like cooking,
whereas you
add spices that actually may enhance each other, although you may not taste that spice. It's bringing out a different kind of flavor. Because you described jasmine, I think it's jasmine grandiflorum, in the book as overwhelming by itself.
It can be.
Okay.
Totally. And if you think about the flower, you smell them when you're outside generally or in a room, and they're somewhat dispersed. And then the extraction may concentrate some parts of the jasmine more than others. And so fairly frequently when I open a bottle in a room doing a perfume class, some people will just say, oh, that's just too much. I don't like that. And again, that's where you come back to, you don't have to use it. You know, the customer, the student, whoever is always right. They may need a little bit of guidance. But people are just very different. And sometimes it's people who have not had a lot of experience with natural fragrances and full-bodied flowers. And it takes a little bit of just accustoming your nose and your sensibilities to that more full experience.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Elise Vernon Perlstein. She's a former wildlife biologist and now a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator. And we're continuing our conversation about her wonderful book, Scent, A Natural History of Fragrance. Now, what I've wanted to talk to you since the first time we talked, we never got to it, are animal-based scents, which they're not a lot, probably probably for good reasons. And I just want to talk about them individually because I've come across them in reading about history. And let's start with musk, which used to be, what was it, about 20, 30 years ago, you used to hear that a lot.
Sure.
For men's stuff. What are the notes of musk?
The notes of musk. Musk, by definition, is animalic.
Yep.
Sensual. Dirty.
When you say dirty, okay.
Let's say earthy.
Okay. Fecal is always interesting. Go ahead.
Sometimes they are. It depends on, I hate to say this, but where the musk comes from. Uranus, spicy. Sometimes they're floral, surprisingly.
Now, where does musk come from?
Well, you said musk. Musk originally refers to the musk deer. Okay. And they live in the highlands of areas around India, and the Himalayas, in a variety around there. And they're very small deer. They're very cryptic. They like to hide and, you know, browse on the underbrush. And when the male is ready to communicate his availability and desire to mate, he deposits his musk on his territory. And that's what musk often is a communication. The male musk deer has a gland on his abdomen with little grains of musk, and he is able to deposit that. And one of the reasons that musk is so useful in perfume is because it is long-lasting.
Okay.
The original purpose is to send a message, and the message is no good if it goes away.
But the way you described it, and I've smelled scents that have been left by animals a lot because I'm outside a lot.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't sound like it would be the great basis for any kind of perfume. I don't care if it's for men or whatever. But musk was used a lot historically even. Is it used as much today?
It was used a lot historically in the pure form from the animals. And sort of camouflaged or masked by also adding florals and spices and citruses. So it was all part of kind of a really probably heady, strong blend.
You know, whenever you fantasize about going back in a time machine to the olden days, like the 1700s, 1600s, I always think about this, that everybody's going to smell heavily of musk and civet. Mainly to disguise how badly they smell to begin with.
Which one is better, right?
Right. But it was fascinating. And you talk about there used to be a tremendous trade with Tibet with musk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those musk deer are now very endangered.
Right.
And they're really working hard to protect them. And people just have, you know, become aware that maybe we don't need to take these products from animals and trap them and find them.
But there's an amazing list in your book. Beavers were used for their scent, but also the castoreum was used as a flavor?
Yeah, ice cream. It's again, you come back to there's, and beaver castoreum is leathery, kind of like you'd expect a beaver to smell, maybe a little bit
okay.
Wet, muddy, but there is a sweetness.
Okay.
And you're not using the entire, you know, you're refining the molecules to get the flavor. But it's a USDA approved flavor.
And civet, which comes from a civet cat, which is not a cat at all.
Right.
It's that's actually disused now because of animal cruelty.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I've read that that's a very strong sort of cat odor.
It is. Very much so. It's very urinous. It's but it was very popular. And again, I go back to making things interesting, using tiny amounts.
Okay.
And most of the musks are considered to add dimension and lift is kind of a hard concept to grasp, but they can transform the florals. In a really subtle way.
Okay.
What we have come to these days, though, is a variety of synthetic musks that are much more straightforward and single molecule.
Now, there's so many interesting things in your book, and I love some throwaway stuff that you have. And it was under civet, I think I read that big cats love Calvin Klein's obsession for men.
Yes. It's surprising, but I guess it goes back to this communication, this musk, this I am here, I am sexy, I'm available. And I've read over and over, and it's not just Calvin Klein, that's the one that's specifically mentioned, but many perfumes with a good musky base will be attractive to the big cats.
That's a good lesson if you're out there hiking in India. Don't wear
your Calvin Klein behind.
Yeah, seriously. Now, finally, ambergris is one of those things that you read a lot about as being a perfume base, especially in the olden days. What's its source?
Ambergris comes from sperm whales, and it is actually a product of their digestive system. And if you read about it, you'll say, oh, it's whale vomit, or you'll read it's whale poop. And I spent a long time looking for kind of whether it was one or the other. And it actually is comes from the small intestine, and it is fecal material.
Wow.
And what happens is these sperm whales eat cuttlefish, which have little sharp parrot-looking beaks, which can, you know, irritate the intestine. Most of the time, the whale can get them back out from the upper digestive system. Sometimes, however, they make it back into the intestines where they begin to be coated by a waxy substance called ambrine.
Okay.
And that usually allows, you know, fecal material to still pass by, but sometimes it will build up and block the digestive system of the whale, and sometimes it can be fatal, and then this giant block of ambergris, waxy, fecal-smelling stuff is released. And when it's first released, it really is smelly. It smells like, you know, what it is, whale dung.
Although I confess that I have no idea what whale dung would smell like. Does it have,
either,
like, notes of the ocean?
After it ages.
Okay.
After, I think when it first comes out of the whale, and the one paper I found says that whalers early on in Boston and that area knew about ambergris because they would open up the whales and this poopy whale stuff would come out. But the magic comes when you age it, and it's still kind of an unknown process, but it just, especially out on the ocean, you can imagine this piece of wax with this building block called ambrion floating around, picking up the fragrance of the sunshine on the water and the seaweed and sea breezes. And a lot of ambergrises will smell different, but you get notes of honey and flowers and musk, moss. I hate to keep saying this, but it's a thing that's really hard to describe. But in a perfume, it really does wonders for the florals, and it lifts them, and it makes them just really interesting and deep and long-lasting.
Now, obviously, ambergris, natural ambergris, is going to be incredibly rare now, as the whales themselves have become a lot less common.
Yes.
Do you ever just find it washed up on the beach? I always imagined that you'd find a piece of ambergris washed up on the beach.
Every time I walk on the beach, I look.
Have you found any?
No. New Zealand seems to be a really good source. I think the whales pass by there on their journeys. And so I know there are a couple of vendors from New Zealand who find it washed up on the beach.
Wow.
It's tricky because it is a whale product. It is protected internationally. And so you can't really buy it. Or you have to be sure you buy it legally. And I've been gifted a few pieces, but I've never had to deal with the complexity of trying to buy it.
God, at least we're all out of time again.
And I haven't even
finished my questions yet. My returning guest tonight has been Elise Vernon Perlstein. She's a former wildlife biologist and now a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator. And she's written a really wonderful book about scent, A Natural History of Fragrance. Elise, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed talking to you again. And I, as always, you ask great questions, and we'll maybe talk again sometime.
Hopefully. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.